LibertyNation.com does not endorse candidates, campaigns, or legislation, and this presentation is no endorsement.
Is that Liz Cheney or Abraham Lincoln? We've got a primary report from Wyoming, plus Mehmet Oz campaign with a self-inflicted wound by a vegetable. Is it terminal? The Trump-Judge Epstein connection deepens, and a long-awaited announcement from the Academy Awards. All right now on this episode of The Uprising.
LibertyNation.com. They're the resistance, but we are the uprising. With Scott Cosenza.
Hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15.
We're in high school, I'd take you behind the gym and beat the hell out of him.
His Twitter account should be suspended.
Right. You want to go to work? Go take the job as an essential worker. Do it tomorrow.
I just don't even know why there aren't uprisings all over the country. Maybe there will be when people realize.
I think possibly that's the most unattractive form in which prejudice can be met in this country, is the rage of the entitled.
I'm high as a kite in my garage and I can see through these guys.
All right, let's get it moving.
Okay.
Put your tray tables in their fully stored and locked position. It's the uprising. Welcome back, Mr. Timothy Elting Donner, LibertyNation.com senior political analyst. And there's lots to analyze this week. Welcome back.
Well, thank you, Scott. Always a pleasure.
I think for me, the most fun story of the political week is Crudité Gate. Are you aware of this?
Crudité Gate.
Yes.
Right. I love how he says, are you aware of this? Knowing full well I'm not. So that
actually I don't
see,
know.
It's a power play. Like, you know, he knows and I don't. So that gives him a superior position.
This concerns Mehmet Oz running for US Dr. Senate Oz, in a state that I was formerly a resident of, Pennsylvania, and his travails there. Do you remember the John Kerry cheesesteak moment when he ordered his cheesesteak with Swiss cheese?
Yes. Yes, right. I did. That was after he came back from a hard afternoon of windsurfing, I believe.
You know, right? There is a great history in this country of these Brahmin types trying to make out like they're, you know, they're
really
one of the commoners with
really
these things.
I greatly enjoy it. It's
instead
one
of just
better
being who they are, by the way, which is more refreshing. Like, you know, if you're a rich guy who never lifts a finger in the kitchen, be a rich guy who never lives a you could just be a guy who doesn't lift a finger in the kitchen. Trump doesn't, he doesn't pretend he cooks or puts crudité platters together.
I think Trump is an example of how much people appreciate authenticity.
Yeah.
I mean, to a degree, I could never have imagined. Yeah. You think about Trump, Scott. He did in the 2016 campaign alone, you could probably count it, a dozen instances of things that he said or did that would have eliminated any other candidate. And yet, because people thought he was so real, so authentic, and they were so thirsty for somebody, anybody who was like a real person, that he became the freaking president of the United States. So,
you know, Tim, the grocery store is a treacherous place for these politicians. We had Bush, the first President Bush, got in some... because he didn't understand how a supermarket scanner worked. Because the last time he went shopping for some food, it had been pre-scanner and they just put the digits in like a, you know, you kids, they don't even probably understand what that's like, but there was an actual.
So they said that, I understand they said the Bush 41, they said it's what the kids are all doing these days with the president.
So he marveled at the technology, and then he was, of course, portrayed as a person who, you know,
completely out of touch,
who was an idiot, right? Exactly. Like, you know, he's trying to deal with. I mean, I don't think he dealt well with them, but he is dealing with, you know, problems of global governance, not checking out. But anyway, then we had I'm trying to remember, was it wasn't Kerry? Somebody. you know, they did one of these gotcha questions like, hey, do you know who the ambassador to whatever Stan is? And then the person doesn't, you know, and they look like, right. you know, that's what being president is, knowing the name of some guy who's like president of like a county in Delaware, like the size of, you know, that's the country. And like, you're supposed
to
know.
Okay, so you don't know that then. Okay, right. Let's move to the next question.
Exactly. Yes. It's so funny.
Okay, so that's a you don't know. Okay, next question.
But he was asked like how much a quart of milk is or something like that, and he didn't know. And that got him in trouble. And here's Mehmet Oz with crudité gate.
I thought I'd do some grocery shopping. I'm at Wegner's, and my wife wants some vegetables for crudité, right? So here's a broccoli. That's $2. Not a ton of broccoli there. Here's some asparagus. That's $4. Yep. And carrots. That's $4 more. That's $10 of vegetables there. And then we need some guacamole. That's $4 more. And she loves salsa. Yeah, there's salsa there. $6. Must be a shortage of salsa. Guys, that's $20 for crudité. This doesn't include the tequila. I mean, that's outrageous. We got Joe Biden to thank for this.
He said he's
a crudité.
First of all, hold on a second. First of all, he gets the name of the store
joke.
Wrong.
I mean, that was obviously a joke video, right?
This is, by the way, this is he put this out. He gets Wegmans wrong, and people who are.
He said Wegner's.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, like he's a regular there, right? Oh. By the way, what do you know more? What do you know more than the names of the stores in your area that you frequent, like, you know, week by week? You know, are you likely to mislabel the name of the Safeway at the end of the
one thing everybody knows is the name of the closest grocery
that
or
they visit, Tim, only if they visit
close,
it. If they have layers of staff who visit
them, you don't expect.
And you, by the way, Dr. are the Oz worst. I will expose your personal secrets on this podcast. You're the worst supermarket shopper in the world, probably, that anybody's ever met in terms of being able to go and retrieve a single item at a quickness.
No, that's not the problem.
Oh, excuse me.
The problem is that if you're not intimately familiar.
Oh, because you don't do it regularly, you don't know where the
right.
stuff is.
Well, the problem is I'll go to one end of the store and get six items, and I have four more to get. I go to the
By
other
the way,
end.
And get I'll three say this.
And then realize that the fourth item is all the way back at the other end.
I'll say
that
this.
To me is so inefficient, it drives me batty.
I will say this, and I will have no comment from you about it, lest you feel compelled to issue an untruth. Maybe. By brilliant design, you have created a circumstance by which you're so unreliable at getting things from the store that you are not then tasked with getting things from the store. So,
Scott,
pure genius. Pure genius.
Me.
If that's, you know, when I was a kid, did not want to mow the lawn, I would flood the mower with the primer button so that it wouldn't start. And then I could say,
I will say this. Beyond a categorical denial that I would ever be bad on purpose, so I'm not going to be asked to do it again. I would never, ever, ever do that, Scott. But I do suffer from what my wife calls male blindness,
same.
Which is I can go into a supermarket and look at an item right in front of me that I'm supposed to get. And call her up and say, I'm sorry they don't have it.
Right. I actually forgot the best, it's not a grocery store story, but the best sort of Brahmin meeting with the hoi polloi is the Sergeant Shriver Kvassier.
Yes, sir. That was the best.
Can you share that with everybody?
Okay, so Sergeant Shriver is running as the vice president for, wait a minute. Was he running for governor or the Senate, or what was he running for?
I think he was on the VP side.
But he ran as the VP for McGovern way back in 72. Was it then? It was later. Well, anyway, or he's on behalf of the Kerry campaign or something like that.
I'm going to let Wikipedia direct us here. He was the Democratic Party's nominee for vice president in the 1972 presidential.
Right, with McGovern. But it was much later than that, I think. Anyway, look, here's the point that he was, he became the poster child.
Unsuccessfully sought the presidential nomination in 76, by the way.
Could that have been it?
Yeah.
Maybe that was it. Okay, so he goes to Pittsburgh. As I recall, it was Pittsburgh, you know, shot in a beer town, right?
Absolutely.
And
Iron City.
Yeah. So he walks into a pub or a bar, and the cameras are following him. And he says, I'm trying to remember exactly what he said, but he bellied up to the bar, and with the cameras rolling, he asked for a Courvoisier, which is, you know what? If it didn't exist, it would have to be invented as the ultimate elitist drink, yeah. Wouldn't it?
Hilarious.
Courvoisier.
Yeah, you're right. They would even have it too, by the way. It's kind of funny.
It's perfect.
So I think that the cheesesteak thing actually hurt Kerry just a little bit. The guy who is now, I don't know if he's on CNN and Sirius, but Michael Smirkanish is a Philadelphia media guy. He's now a national media guy. And he actually, back when he was a real Republican, I think he's gone away from that. But in any case, he out of his pocket financed a commercial against John Kerry with the Swiss cheese incident. Let's just get back on track here. The challenger says, in Pennsylvania, we call that a veggie plate. And as somebody who's born in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania and resided there for a long time, I can confirm it is, in fact, called a veggie plate in the Commonwealth, not crudité.
By the way, I love how you slip in Commonweal.
There you go.
Like the traditional 18th century spelling of the word. Tim, impressive. Yes.
Verbal salt and pepper for the people.
You're such a man of the people. That's the thing I love about you, Scott. When people say, what's that guy Cosenza? Like I said, he is above all else a man
of the people. I have always hated carpetbaggers. Politicians who move into a place because they see the opportunity to gain an office there. And I don't think outsized charitable views of politicians, but I do think that if you're from a people and you actually are from a region, you're more likely to do well representing that region and understand what are, you know,
you think issues. Really? And, you think that makes a difference?
You know, I hated when I think the first, you know, Hillary, of course, is a great example on the left. I remember when Elizabeth Dole ran for Senate and in North Carolina, was it?
Yes.
And like, I know that she, you know, like a week before, you know, they're talking about their Kansas bona fides and Kansas. And of course, they're from, I think, McLean or somewhere in Northern Virginia.
Inside the Beltway.
Yeah, totally inside the Beltway. You know, and Bob Dole, like, I think he spent like 10 minutes in Kansas when he was senator.
He's legitimately from Kansas, at least. Yeah.
Well, absolutely from, but didn't spend a lot of time there. Right. I think he rented a hotel room to go, like, you know, spend the night before election.
Well, it's not like Al Gore, who grew up in a hotel room in D.C., right? But then you have Liz Cheney. That the carpetbagger thing works with Cheney too, because even though, I mean, the only reason Liz Cheney ever was elected to begin with was because of her father's name, who's still the most.
She's not from Wyoming. She's from
McLean.
Fairfax County, Virginia.
Inside the Beltway, right?
Absolutely.
And so when she went, this was a great one, actually, Scott. In 2000, was it 16 or 18 or 20, whenever it was, in one of her races, she parachuted into Wyoming. And she wore a pair of jeans to try and fit.
Oh, I heard this. I heard this week. I know that you addressed.
I didn't.
The Cheney election, and we're going to talk about it in a minute here.
I
regret, go ahead and tell this part of the story.
The pair of blue jeans was so new that the dye came off on her hands when she was shaking hands with people, because she obviously had never worn them or probably any other pair of jeans in her entire life.
They should have made her get on a horse and see how she did there. Well, just to turn it back around, Mehmet Oz, I think, is a carpetbagger in the sense that he's not a Pennsylvanian. He lived his life in New Jersey. He was a New Jerseyan. And as a former resident of New Jersey, I appreciate that. But also, it's a different place. And I don't think
wouldn't that have appeal, though, to people that live in the greater Philadelphia area, because that does include New Jersey.
Absolutely. And also the opposite of that in the middle of the state.
Too. Right.
You know, and the idea that the West, you know, the idea that, you know, if you live in, you know, Center County, Pennsylvania, or Elk County, Pennsylvania, and, you know, you're going to basically elect a guy from like Paramus. I mean, you know, to represent you. And I mean,
well, it's a totally weird race, that Pennsylvania Senate race, because, you know, Dr. Oz, I'll just tell you, my personal view was before he ran for the Senate was they kept putting him on Fox News, Dr. Oz during the pandemic. And he'd come on with this huge backdrop and this big, you know, Dr. Oz here, Dr. Oz there at his big
Chiron
show. Yeah, everywhere. And I said, you know, I don't want a doctor, you know, giving me advice on TV so that he can look smart, right? I don't want a celebrity doctor who's more concerned with his celebrity than he is with being a doctor. That's
celebrity, why celebrity and money. That's what this guy's.
And by the way, I will also say that this tends to happen in these upper class circles where they have these so-called society doctors that, you know, all the blue bloods go to. And many times those people are just flat out incompetent, Scott. It's amazing, actually. But
I don't know if he's incompetent as a doctor. I know sure that he has concealed his financial interest in health supplement type things and advocated for them.
I think it's a total mess, too, because he's not sincere. In 2016, he hated Trump. Now he takes his endorsement and acts like he's a Trump advocate. But, you know, it just runs. This kind of stuff runs far and wide. For example, I don't think you knew that the woman that defeated Liz Cheney was
Wait a second. We're going to get into
I'm going to bring it back to the Pennsylvania race, because Harriet Hageman, who is the woman that defeated Liz Cheney, was also an anti-Trump person in 2016. And now all of a sudden she's totally down with America First. So these people, and Oz is a guy who was anti-Trump. Now he's pro-Trump. Is that right? And he's running for Pennsylvania, but he's really from New Jersey. I think he's a slam dunk to lose because of all of this stuff, except for the fact that the Democrat is a guy who suffered a stroke literally days before the Democratic primary, John Fetterman. And he's a total wild card. He's kind of a progressive, but not a predictable virtue signaling one.
All right. I think we've already spent too much time on this race.
But that's an interesting, it's a pivotal race.
Well, we're going to pay attention to the Senate. It.
Yeah.
Let's turn our attention to, the Wyoming race. And as an opener, I'll ask you, do you think that Ms. Hageman will be seen like a John Wilkes Booth eventually, you know, and with through the lens of history, Tim?
Well, I have we know that
Ms. Cheney is now
Cheney. You used the Cheney thing.
I did. Oh, that's please. The
that's what Chris Matthews did.
Exactly.
Well,
right.
He called himself Cheney once, so I'm going to call him Cheney. Oh, please.
It was so funny when he did that.
Is that how they pronounce it in the Commonweal?
Hey, that's a real word.
Yes, indeed.
But for those that aren't aware, she did compare herself to Abraham Lincoln. Let's go ahead and listen to Liz Cheney.
The great and original champion of our party, Abraham Lincoln, was defeated in elections for the Senate and the House before he won the most important election of all. Lincoln ultimately prevailed. He saved our Union, and he defined our obligation as Americans for all of history. Speaking at Gettysburg of the great task remaining before us, Lincoln said that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from this earth.
Liz Cheney fancies herself Joan of Arc. She's on
and Lincoln and Lincoln too.
She's a religious. She's on a religious mission, and as I wrote in my piece, the fatal deceit or conceit, I should say, the fatal conceit of Liz Cheney. She lived the part on Tuesday because she was burned at the political stake. Her singular goal in life is to stop Donald Trump from becoming president again. That's all she's interested in, and she will do anything to stop him, which is why the absurd notion of running for president after you've been repudiated in
your own
party's primary by 37%.
Tim, she's a three-term.
37%.
I don't think you're looking at the record. She's a three-term congresswoman. She served in the House of Representatives for three consecutive terms. Now, if that's not a rock-solid launching pad to become president of the United States, Tim, I don't know what possibly could be. That's
what
I think record of achievement.
This is how perverse the inside the beltway mentality is when your whole, you know, it's what I call the bubble wrapped environs of the DC swamp, you know, and going to Wyoming with a brand new pair of jeans that actually the dye comes off them because they're so new. I mean, look, on the one hand, the concept of her running for president after getting beaten by 37% as a sitting congresswoman in the single congressional district in Wyoming. The absurdity of it is self-evident. And yet, on another level, the concept of her running for president makes sense in terms of her life mission, because she knows she's not going to become president. But I think she believes that if she runs likely as an independent, which would be the smart move for her, that she could siphon enough votes away from Trump to deny him another term. And that's all she cares about. That's her singular mission in life. And Scott, it must be.
Well, hold on. Let me interrupt you with a question.
Look what she's willing to do for it.
And I know that this is speculation, but I, you know, whatever. That's what we're doing. Is that because that's her path to gain in power and influence? The most direct path is to be the lead anti-Trumper? Or is it some other thing that's motivating her?
Well, part of it is the death pangs of neoconservatism.
Okay.
I mean, yep. Let's talk about that.
Let's open that box just for a second. So I think, so for me, I think I've said it before on the podcast, you know, Dick Cheney before 9/11.
I'm sorry, it's Cheney.
Before 9/11, his politics were mine. Rarely did he say something I disagreed with or voted in a way that I would have him vote differently. He was an extremely limited government guy. And then he never found a war that or military war spending or increase in restriction on civil liberties, it seemed like after 9/11, that he disagreed with. And Liz Cheney is like her father in that regard. She's a warmonger.
Never saw a war she didn't like.
And also on other civil liberty stuff and like drug war stuff, she's real bad. So for me, you know, you see a write-up of her in the legacy media, and it's like, you know, it sounds like she's a libertarian, like extreme small government. It's like, well, except for this massive, huge government we have to make wars on every continent on Earth, right? I mean, that's
she has to explain away the fact that that she supported Trump 93% of the time in terms of his congressional agenda. And yet she is sleeping with the enemy by not only serving on a entirely Soviet style show trial committee.
Well, that's
another TV show, but she's serving as the singular mouthpiece for them. Now, you know, what How is she supposed to, did she think that the Democrats are going to suddenly embrace her? No, they're going to throw her out with yesterday's trash as soon as her usefulness has run out on the September, the January 6th committee. Okay. And Republicans, she's done forever in the Republican Party.
You know, there's a bit about Liz Cheney that's actually quite refreshing. Two things that came up since her defeat. One is that she's started a PAC to basically see that Donald Trump doesn't win. Right. And that's what she's called. That's what she's saying it is. So rather than like pretend it's about something else, you know, she's saying that. And also when asked if she's running for president, I don't have the clip because it's only a nanosecond. She basically says, I'm looking, you know, I haven't made any decisions about that. But, you know, in other words, she didn't pretend that she wasn't looking at it. Now, I think it's preposterous as I think.
No, she's not pretending. Well. She's refused to rule it out.
No. What I mean is, I wish I had the clip to play you because you would agree with me. I think if you heard it is that, in other words, it was a candid. The thing that drives me nuts is when these people lie through their teeth, like they pretend that they have no interest in the office or like. President, I hadn't even thought. What's
well,
that?
How
does that work?
How about when they name
that job?
How about when they name a major piece of legislation about climate and taxes, and they call it the Inflation Reduction Act, which it has nothing to do with reducing inflation. In fact, is likely to increase inflation. That's all nomenclature, and that's what they do in Washington. They present something as a, you know, one thing when it's really another.
Just real quick, there's actually a coda to the race there with Hageman claiming that Cheney didn't call to concede and or didn't concede during a call that she made. And then Cheney actually publishing the call. I just want to go back to back and listen to these two real quick.
Let's talk about I watched her speech last night. I think she's sincere in her beliefs. She's allowed to believe anything that she wants, pursue any agenda that she wants. But clearly, at some point, she got out of touch with the people of Wyoming, which is why you won by such an overwhelming margin. She mentioned that she called you. I didn't hear in that sentence that she congratulated you and wished you well. How did the call go?
Well, there wasn't a phone call. While I was going in and getting ready to do my acceptance speech last night and had just arrived at the watch party, she called and left a very brief 2-second message on my cell phone. That's the extent of it. I haven't had any other contact with Liz Cheney. She only made the one effort, and all she said was, "Hello, Harriet," and then that was the end of it. So she didn't call and discuss with me any kind of concession or anything else. It was just a one phone call. I was obviously extremely busy. Busy with family and friends.
She just said, "Hello, Harriet," and hung up?
That was the end of the call, yes. That was the only time. It was about 8:15 last night, and I was just getting ready to go on stage with my acceptance speech, and I didn't have an opportunity to visit with her.
AP's calling it. So where'd you go?
Hi, Harriet. Liz Cheney calling. It's about 8:13 on Tuesday the 16th. I'm calling to concede the election and to congratulate you on the win. Thanks. Bye-bye.
That kind of thanks, which is, you know, that's maybe insincere, but I actually think that this is, you know, necessary and sufficient, and the class move is to say congratulations and I concede. That's how the tradition has been in American politics, and I think that Liz Cheney followed it. She doesn't need to say you know, nice things about the person who ran or their family right, or their camp. Like, thank you, congratulations, I can see.
Yeah, that's all that's required.
Yeah.
And she can't be expected to do more than that. But you know, this whole thing brings to mind something that Richard Nixon once said, and it was more of a political observation than it was any kind of policy or anything. He said, and it's great food for thought, he said, anytime there's a stop somebody or something movement,
right,
go with the thing they're trying to stop or the person that they're trying to stop.
Why is that?
Well, I think what he did, what he's done is he's looked historically and he's seen that when there's big movements to stop this person or that person, it generally accrues to that person's benefit because people look at it and say, why are they trying to stop him? Is that all they've got? I don't appreciate the idea of somebody in forging an entire narrative and an entire belief system on stopping somebody.
Didn't Bill Buckley run for governor of New York on a stop
mayor?
Yeah.
He stopped as mayor. Yeah. Right.
Mayor Lindsay,
you remember
right?
the quote?
Was it an anti-Mayor Lindsay campaign?
Yes, it was. Well, let's see, it was 1965.
Right.
And I remember he ran for mayor as a protest candidate. And he was probably the most famous political quote in Italy's New York
phone book.
Political history. Well, the phone book thing where he said he'd rather be governed by the first 1,000 names, any of the first 1,000 names in the phone book than the people currently governing. But the famous thing was they asked him as a protest candidate, what if you win? What would you do if you win? And his answer was, demand a recount.
That was
one of the great political lines of all time.
Do you think that Hageman is going to, you know, be just the, you know, she's in the center of attention now, right? Because she defeated Cheney,
she's going to
be forgotten about already, right? Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. She's totally inconsequential because whoever was running against Cheney, I will say this though, that having looked at this race closely for a long time and looked at how other people were looking at it, I thought a 20 to 30 point defeat, a landslide of 20 to 30 points was likely. The fact that it was a 37% defeat for Cheney tells me that the rebound effect on the Mar-a-Lago raid was real, that it emboldened.
All right, here's your total speculation moment. You said it was
37%.
What is that number without the raid on Mar-a-Lago?
Well, I think it's between 20 and 30, maybe as high as 30.
Yeah.
That's my, you know, I can't prove that.
Yeah.
But I followed the few polls that there were on the race, but there were more than there usually would be because of the unusual national attention on a single congressional race in Wyoming.
Right.
Because of the role Liz Cheney played. And she was pretty much in the background as just another political hack, basically. Albeit a smart one and someone who's a serious person in terms of her policy knowledge and stuff like that. But, you know, it was only her hatred of Trump that made her a national figure. But if she goes, as she will, if she runs for president, it'll obviously be only to stop Trump. That's where the Nixon formulation comes in. I wonder if it will be a boomerang effect by having the singular life goal and campaign goal of denying Donald Trump votes.
Well, she'll, after that concludes, she'll settle into her MSNBC hosting duties just fine, I think.
Or she'll go and become a K-Street. She will, as I put it in the article, mosey down the block to K-Street and make 20 times her congressional salary lobbying Congress.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Trump for a minute in that raid. We don't have much in the way of news. There's a hearing today. We're recording about 10 something in the morning on the 18th. And there is a hearing about releasing the affidavit of probable cause in support of the search warrant. And as I think I've said before, that's where you get all the goodies. That's where they really lay out all the kind of roadmap for the stuff they're after and why. So that will tell us a lot if we get it, if it is substantially unredacted. Now, the judge may rule that it's not going to come out at all. The judge may rule that it comes out with, you know, some light redactions, or it comes out with, you know, you've seen these returns from the FOIA requests that are like a entire black page with one word on it. Right.
Right.
It could be something like that.
Heavily redacted.
Right. But the judge, you know, I can't remember if it was on the Uprising or on LibertyNation.com senior video. Or excuse me, senior. I'm doing my intro to you.
That's great. LibertyNation.com. That's a great outtake right there.
LibertyNation.com's premier video product, the Conservative 5 or C5. And I basically was poo-pooing the notion that this guy had any affiliation with Epstein because he had represented some people in Epstein's universe. But I'm withdrawing that now, Tim. And the reason why is because of reporting I saw, I think at Politico, and I hadn't realized this, is not only did he represent multiple Epstein confidant people, one of the sort of abused folks, allegedly, and his pilot, one of his main pilots for the Lolita Express, but he did it, Tim. He resigned from his position as a prosecutor, and then the next day started his engagement with those multiple Epstein clients. So actually, I think maybe there is some interesting, perhaps, and it could just be pay for play. Like, you know, I'm not suggesting he's involved in any like grand conspiracy with Epstein, but it's more than just guy walks into his office and says, hey, I'm in trouble. I need some help, you know, to resign and then have these clients in place literally the following day to make appearances for them. That's what Politico reported.
Well, that's what I call an efficient business operation, Scott. He's able to turn around big clients in 24 hours. Yeah, that's sure. Why he gets paid the big bucks.
It's been misreported that Trump appointed him. Now, I never misreported it because I did my due diligence. You know, he was appointed to his position as a magistrate judge by the court itself. Oftentimes these magistrate positions, you know, they're kind of a necessary functionary in the you know, right. The wheels of justice. Right.
And let's talk about the demand, request, whatever, for the affidavit to be released. Sure. I got two questions for you. First is, I don't want to ask a leading question, counselor, right. But is it not an extraordinary measure to actually release an affidavit in this kind of instance? And the second thing is, what do you make of the fact that Trump, unlike most people who are under investigation, who don't want the details of the bad stuff out there, the fact that Trump himself is demanding the release of the affidavit, what do you make of that?
Okay, so to the first question, this is no ordinary case. Right. These things would never be released at this stage. What I mean by that is, if you're examining the affidavit to challenge a search or something like that, later on, after the department has completed their investigative steps and made their arrests and their charging decisions, that's when you might see the affidavit released with redactions, by the way. If there's a confidential source or, you know, a police informant kind of a thing, that's the kind of thing you would expect to see redacted, unless there was some overweening reason to you know, present it to a challenging authority. But not this early, not right away, not right after the warrant served. Absolutely no, you would not expect to see it. I would say that, you know, Trump has two things he's dealing with. Number one is the actual case, if you will, this case of potential mishandling of classified documents that is potentially a legal case that he has to deal with. Results that, you know, or potential consequences that could maybe include incarceration. That's a real thing. You know that they would love to do it, right? I mean, like, can you imagine the parades that would be in the streets for, you know, these people who think that Donald Trump is like Hitler, you know, if they could get him behind bars? That's one thing. I think for Trump, this is, of course, my speculation. That's a minor thing. The major thing is the political theater of it all. How does it benefit him politically?
Right.
I think he desperately wants to be president of the United States again. And I think he's trying to game it so that that it furthers that goal. You know, he didn't release the search warrant, Tim, or the property receipt until a couple days after the search. Now, it's his prerogative to release it whenever he wants, but you know, they weren't actually direct about why they weren't releasing it. So, and I'm not going to play the clip just for time's sake, but there was Trump's lawyer was on Fox News, and they and when asked directly if she was going to release the search warrant, they said, "Well, we don't have. We're still trying to work with the Justice Department to talk to them and resolve this." It's like, what are you talking about? It was just some really, for anybody who knows the score, just total BS stalling. Instead of just forthrightly saying we choose not to release it at this time for whatever reason, you know. So that was
gamesmanship. Well, they're so insecure about what they've done. I mean, they don't have much of a boldness about. Of course, we should have done this. This was the right thing to do, and you'll find out soon enough. I think it's a, you know, the way I see it, and I tend to see things strictly through a political lens. That's what I'm paid to do. I see this Republican strategy as a high-risk, high-reward strategy. The let's see the affidavit, demanding the release of the affidavit, figuring, Scott, that Garland's not going to do it. So if they demand it, and even Trump demands it, and Garland refuses to release it, it just adds to the idea that Trump's being persecuted. Yeah. So in terms of the political theater, it makes a whole lot of sense. Of course, the high risk of it is that he does release the affidavit, and it makes Trump look worse in the eyes of people who are undecided about whether they might vote for him again in 2024.
And I'll just say this again. I think it needs to be said often because of the messaging that the legacy media is sort of, I think, really mirroring and mega, you know, putting out with their megaphones, which is that nobody is above the law, and that if Donald Trump broke the law, he needs to be subject to it. And well, if Donald Trump is the only person similarly situated that is subject to the law, then that doesn't make him equal to the law. It makes him below it. If the speed limit is 55 and nobody ever gets pulled over for going between 55 and 63, and Donald Trump goes 56 and you put out, you know, the stop sticks for
an
him
APB
and do a pit maneuver to crash his car to give him the 56 mile an hour ticket. And you don't even just write him the ticket, but you effectuate a custodial arrest because the law allows that, even though nobody's ever it's been done to them. But you treat Donald Trump that way. That is not treating someone equal to the law. And that is their allegation. Now, maybe there's something else going on, and I'm open to that going on. I'm open to the possibility that this is behavior and actions that would never have taken place against a kind of basically
center.
Well, no, even right center, and basically the kind of uniparty establishment type, right? Whether it's George W. Bush,
true, yes.
Or you know,
right? They wouldn't be raiding Mitt Romney,
right?
Or John McCain's when he was alive. What do you think? This is an important question, and I don't think there's a clear answer to it. Which is why it's still being discussed. The idea that what they really want to do is prosecute him, indict him, so that he can't run for president.
Yeah.
What is the threshold for, and what various ways? We know that if he was impeached and convicted in the Senate, that he could not run for political office again. But under what other circumstances, as you see it, will he be literally unable to run for office in 2024? Under what circumstances?
Didn't Lyndon LaRouche run from his jail cell?
He did. Yes, he did.
Didn't Democrat Lyndon LaRouche run from his jail cell for president?
Was he Democrat at that point?
Oh, no.
He's
always been a Democrat, Tim. Lyndon LaRouche.
Yeah. So he did it from prison. He was convicted, right? Or was he just being held for trial?
I think he was a convict at that point. Yeah.
Okay, so he was a convict and he ran for president. Okay, well, that kind of answers the question. But there will be a huge constitutional debate about that.
Well, the law that Trump implicated in potentially breaking has as a specific part of the penalty this inability to run for office. And that's why, like, upon conviction, basically that's part of the sentence, if you will. And I think that's why they're playing for keeps, right? I mean, they're not some pikers. That's the reason for it. It seems to me is to prevent that from happening. But here's the other thing. That's going to be a case of first impression. It's not like we have got this body of case law where it's like, oh yeah, well that's the law and that's what happens. You're talking about,
unprecedented. There's that word again.
Well, not only that, but the Constitution is the document that decides who can run for what, their ages, their qualifications, right? And so there's a legitimate, and I think I would even say this, dare I say, Tim, for somebody like a Hillary Clinton, who I think, you know, I have a record of thinking, you know, espousing my beliefs that she's perhaps the most corrupt, awful candidate in history. So I would not welcome her candidacy. But I can tell you that I think that she, even if she were convicted of some kind of mishandling of, government documents or the murder of Vincent Foster or at any number of the crimes that I believe that she's committed, and serious crimes. I mean that not the murder part sincerely, but I mean it sincerely that I believe that she has committed many federal crimes, that she should be able to run for president, that she should not be legally forbidden from doing so. And that if she were, it would be appropriate for courts.
Of course, you also believe she should be doing it from prison.
Certainly. Yeah.
I defend to the death her right to run for president as an incarcerated federal prisoner.
That's not a that's exactly right.
You are
right.
So principled, Scott. I just it just breath.
And then she could, by the way, pardon herself for the federal crimes if she were in fact inaugurated. Which would be interesting.
I sure remember at one point they were talking about that Trump would pardon himself as a preemptive pardon. Yeah.
By the way, he may still have. He may have. But in other words, he may have signed that pardon and put it in his pocket, you know, as he was on Air Force One, as you know, right before Joe Biden got sworn in. In other words, there's no rule that a pardon be published. Okay, so. I'll tell you what, if I were Donald Trump and I was president of the United States and I saw how they came after me with all that fake stuff they invented the entire national security apparatus, basically said that Donald Trump was in league with,
they said he was a traitor.
They said he was a traitor. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so anyway, maybe I would do that for me and my family, you know, just write a bunch of pardons. Stick them in my breast pocket and walk out the door. And then if they're ever needed, they're there. And if they're not, they're not. But here's the thing, Tim, just to be clear for anybody who's interested in the nitty gritty, you can't pardon yourself for something you did after you're president while you're president. You can pardon yourself up to that moment that you actually sign the pardon, right? That's pardoned behavior. But these are allegations about what he did post-president. So he wouldn't, even if he did have a pardon.
Oh, wait a minute. Post-president. In terms of the documents.
That's exactly right. Yeah, he can handle a document any way he wants while he's president.
I mean, the strategy on the left, on the other hand, the strategy on the right is to demand the release of the first warrant, but much more importantly, the affidavit, knowing it probably won't happen and it adds fuel to the fire of conspiracy.
Well, there are media companies, too, that are...
But on the left, okay, on the left, the strategy is to throw in the N-word nuclear to scare people and then to talk as much as they can about the Espionage Act, because then it makes him again look like a traitor and a spy, to the point where Michael Beschloss, did you hear what he said this week? The establishment left.
The official
left-wing historian.
Doris Kearns Goodwin.
Exactly in that tradition. Right. Basically said.
Tim, she's slowing down.
Talk about taking speculation. He said the Espionage Act, and if true, which of course is the left's favorite expression, if true, like Russia collusion, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg were executed for that. That's what Michael Beschloss said. And then one of his colleagues, he wrote that in a tweet.
Right.
And then one of his colleagues, and I'm forgetting it at the moment who it was, but somebody who's a respected historian or something, wrote, "Sounds about right."
Yep. Yeah. Before they,
in other words,
they're
openly saying that he would welcome the execution of Donald Trump. That's where we are, Scott.
The thing that I just wonder about that is, how many Americans are they willing to see engage in civil war-like behavior to execute a Donald Trump? Can they build a prison that'll hold Donald Trump that won't have daily people trying to drive through the walls with their trucks to get him out because of, you know, the perception that he's a political prisoner?
Well, he is everything they always feared but never thought would come about, which is someone who's absolutely unwilling to go along with a corrupt
establishment.
Indeed, utterly unwilling, not just someone who's like a critic from within the system like Ted Cruz, who's essentially part of the establishment.
And then he takes money from Goldman to get his office. So, yeah, he's a real head of the establishment.
Trump is the thing that they cannot countenance. They cannot allow him to continue because they know he snuck up on them the first time. They conspired to take him down the second time, and they succeeded in it. They even admitted that they conspired. All the major elements of American society conspired to take him down, all the power centers. But they know that if he comes in for a second term now, he is going to clean out the civil service. For starters, he instituted something called Schedule K.
Yeah, we talked about this.
That would basically gut the protections of civil service employees. But that's just the start of it. I mean, he's getting his people installed in positions like Secretary of State across the country so that they control the voting systems in individual states. I mean, the extent of his reach in a second term and his ability, having seen what it's like and having had the hard knocks, to say the least, of 4 years and all the targeting of him, that he would complete the job that they're so afraid that he is intent on doing.
You know, the reason why we're dealing with all this is because of a complaint filed by David Ferriero, who was the archivist of the United States, the head of the National Archives and Records Administration. And this is a person who retired when he did so that Joe Biden would make his replacement. This is supposed to be, by the way, a non-political job. I mean, the president does appoint the person, but before David Ferriero, there wasn't an archivist who discussed timing their replacement to game the system so that their preferred choice in a president could issue their replacement. And nobody discusses how disgusting that is, because
but Scott, it's a nonpartisan position. It's not a political appointment. And don't you understand?
And nobody discusses how disgusting it is because, of course, he's doing the right thing, meaning it's Trump. So all norms are wrong.
All the rules are thrown.
And then he made this comment, which I just thought was so, well, here, you can just listen.
Right. Okay. So if you were giving any advice to your successor about the best thing to do in this job, what would you tell him or her? There's never been a female archivist, has there?
No, I would. And that's advice I've given to the White House already, that you better not hire another white male. That we've had 10 white males. What advice would I give that person? Fight for more money. Get to know your staff. You have an extraordinary staff. Don't bring a posse in here and get to know your talent before you make any moves. And learn the history of the agency.
So now the position of Librarian of Congress, your position has no fixed term. Is that right?
Right.
So a president appoints you, but there's no fixed term.
Right.
So you're retiring just because you want to retire.
I want this administration to be the administration that replaces me.
Okay. It used to be that the Librarian of Congress was appointed for life.
same. Yeah, that was that.
Used to be appointed for life, but it's changed now. And it's a 10-year appointment and then can be renewed for another 10 years. Is that right?
Right.
And it stop it now.
Thank you.
For more money, get to know you.
So I just want to say how disgusting it is.
What a drone.
That you have a white guy, okay, who's gotten every prestigious job in his career, okay, from the archivist to before that, the things that he was able to be a part of and do. And I'm sure that he got those things because of his work and achievement. I don't think his dad was the national archivist and he got but to some other person who's exactly situated as he was, which is to say, now he's Ferriero, I assume he's Italian, he's, you know, so I'm not going to make you get into the differentiation between who's white and who's not, but let's just say that society accepts him as a white guy.
That's good.
But the idea, like, does he sit his son down and say, you should go be a ditch digger? Why? Well, nobody should hire you as an archivist because of the color of your skin and because of your sexual identity or biology. I just think it's so, like, the idea that you're allowed to go after
so sickening
and say that about
it's just this virtue signaling so he can sound and appear to be woke so he can be in the good grace.
I think we have to call it out.
Scott,
all the
time. You don't understand. How else do you expect
he should
him
be
to stay on the A list for all those Washington cocktail parties?
I think that what should happen to him is exactly what should happen to a person who says, "Just don't hire a black guy, no matter what you do, because we know that they're awful."
I agree with you.
The same consequences should suffer somebody who sincerely believes that. I'm not talking about somebody who makes some joke. But who says, don't hire this race? Don't, you know, we're talking about a position of public trust. And boy, we got to go after these people. You know,
it's grounds to me. That kind of admission is grounds for immediate dismissal.
There was a story this week.
But the point is that, you know,
there's a story this week out of Detroit.
White males need not apply.
Yeah.
I mean, that's essentially what he's putting out the shingle. And this guy, this guy lived in anonymity and probably made a nice salary and prestigious position and all that. Now he's made himself notorious through this. Oh, he's the guy that said they shouldn't hire a guy like him to follow him. Right. That's like stealing an election and then saying, we should never allow elections to be stolen right? You know,
yeah.
Or killing your parents and then throwing yourself on the mercy of the court as an orphan.
Why did he take the job if he was so tired of white males occupying that position?
He should have resigned on principle. After the George Floyd affair.
There's a fun. I don't know if it's not Steven Crowder. It's one of these guys who goes to campus, a conservative who goes to campuses and films, you know, people's reactions to conservative ideas. And the interviewer saying to this person who's like this Native American type of a protest is like, should we give the land, like, you know, did we, you know, go through like a parade of horribles and like, should we give them the land back? And she's like, you know, this young college student's like, yes. And he's like, okay, like, what are you doing about it? Why are you still here? What are you still doing here? You said you should give it back. Move. Yeah.
Ben
Shapiro went to like Dartmouth, I think it was, and some white student was like, I'm occupying a position. You know, he's like, are you occupying a position, you know, that might have gone to a minority? The kid says, yeah. And he says, so why are you still here? Why did you take the position? You know, they want to have all the hosannas of being and the hero's cape, but also not give up their job or their position because they earned it and they should keep it. And this guy should have been the archivist, because I'm sure he earned that spot. But to say to the next person, you can't do that job because of the color of your skin, because it's white, is just as vile and disgusting as it is.
After he quits as a white male. Talk about easy for him to say. That is, you know, there's something where you can really strip away everything else and see that it's a 100% political virtue signaling statement. That's 100% virtue signaling, which is something I have absolute contempt for.
You know, also in big news, Tim, this week, I'm sure you are aware, but maybe not everybody who's listening. Big announcement this week from the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, Dateline, August 15, 2022. The Sachin Littlefeather apology. Sachin Littlefeather stepped onto the stage at the 45th Academy Awards, declining Marlon Brando's Oscar on his behalf.
Oh, yeah.
The Academy released an apology letter because I guess she was not welcomed with open arms. And now, instead of being outraged by somebody who wanted to go and dump all over their industry awards ceremony, now, because of racial politics, they have to have to say, I guess maybe they should have just given the award to her for best actress because she was an Indian lady who, by the way, is a fake. Like her. It's funny because, you know, she was Sachin Littlefeather. Wow, that's an interesting name. Where'd you get that? Well, she made it up. Because her name was like Maria Cruz or something like that. And she, you know, she had
really
some,
is yeah, that absolutely. Serious? She just yeah. made up the she little just made feather it up. Yeah. thing.
She used to wear a little feather, and so she got the little feather, and Sachin was like some nickname of hers. Now she did have Indian ancestry. But just like Elizabeth Warren, she was not a tribal member and like had no association with it. You know, it's like somebody who's Jewish and never went to a synagogue or
right.
didn't do any of the, you know.
But then she discovered her inner Indian.
Yeah, she was Indian by ethnicity. That's right. She discovered it so that she could be in Hollywood and get up in front of the Oscars.
So let me ask you this. I got a tough question for you. This is a really tough one. For virtue signaling, which is worse, Hollywood or DC? Hollywood's yeah, even worse.
Hollywood's. Okay. Oh, did you see the what's the person's name? Ellen Page, Elliot Page controversy? I think that was last week's trans outrage. So there's this person who is an actor named Elliot Page, who used to be an actress named. No. Yeah. Okay. I think they're now an actor named Elliot Page, and they used to be an actress named Ellen Page, a female to male trans person.
Okay.
And there was some like discussion of a movie that this person did when they were Ellen Page. And it was like, oh, she did a great job as, I don't know, it was like Harry Potter or something like that.
You can't do that. You can't
right.
do
well,
that.
Well, it's like, well, wait a second, though, but the person who is Elliot Page, even if you do, and I'm happy to call this person whatever they change their name to, Elliot Page, but they were a person named Ellen Page, and that person was a she who played female roles in movies. So it becomes a question of now they want to like memory hole. It wasn't Ellen Page, Tim, right. who did that acting. It was Elliot Page. And it's like, well, no, that's not true, though. It wasn't that person. It was this, but then there's this whole thing of like dead naming in the trans community, yep. where some people do it to insult and demean the trans person, and that's totally not cool. But also to do it as a factual matter, just to report that was Ellen Page. Yeah, I mean that's the idea that we have.
Well, that's how
gaslighting.
It's
gaslighting.
Become, it's totally
of,
gaslighting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, we got sidetracked. Finally, Tim, you know, we've gone many laps on whether or not Karine Jean-Pierre or rather Joe Biden is going to run for re-election. And
by the way, I've got to drop in as a little bouquet to the No Agenda podcast that they call her Karine Abdul Jean-Pierre. I just love I love Karim Abdul Jean-Pierre.
She made her first Sunday morning media appearance on This Week, and they discussed the notion of Biden's re-election. Go ahead and play KJP, as she's known on this podcast.
So before you go, you've seen a lot of Democrats raise, or at least some Democrats in elected office, say that Joe Biden shouldn't run for re-election, that it's time for younger, newer leadership. I'm not going to ask you if he's going to run, because he's already said that he's going
to
run.
He intends to run.
But let me ask you, this was a Maureen Dowd column on last Sunday where she said that he shouldn't run, but made this point. I thought this was interesting. Usually being a lame duck weakens you, but in Biden's case, it could strengthen him. We live in a Washington where people too often put power over principle. So many Republicans have behaved grotesquely out of a fear Trump will turn on them. So the act of leaving could elevate Biden, freeing him from typical re-election pressures, so his team could do what they really thought was right rather than what was politically expedient. So let me just ask you,
yes,
very quickly, and we really are out of time, but is it possible that if he decides not to run, that as a lame duck president, he wouldn't be so lame, and it might actually be better for him?
There are two parts of that that I think are noteworthy. Number one, that he's selling Biden stopping and not running. That's what that is about, right? It's not just some idea of some Twitterverse. The purpose of that is to sell to Biden and the people around him, oh, this could be a great thing for you. Go ahead. And that to me is how I read that. And the second thing is, when asked if he's running, she says that he intends to. Now,
right,
I'm recording this podcast. If you say to me, Scott, are you putting the podcast up this week? I'm not going to say I intend to. I'm going to say yes.
That's right.
Okay. I mean, of course, yes, I intend to, but also yes is the answer, because I'm going to do it. Right. And it, you know, could there be some crazy unforeseen circumstance that leads it to not? Yes, it's possible. But you don't say that when it's something that you are totally committed to doing. You just
that's why he's not totally committed. It's obvious, and he's
I'm just saying they gave away that they gave away the lie there, right?
Yeah. Well, you hear other people saying that he shouldn't run, and it's turned from background whispers into sort of foreground whispers, and a few people willing to say and then say, it doesn't mean I don't like him, because they don't dislike him. They're sad for him and grateful that he took down Trump.
And on that, we'll conclude our political analysis for this week. And thank you for joining us, Mr. Tim Donner, and we'll see your fine work in libertynation.com on the pages of 24/7/365, the viewer and listener's choice for political news and analysis, 24/7/365. See you next week.
Thank you, Scott. Look forward to it.
Bye-bye.
That's it for this edition of The Uprising. Remember to hit Liberty Nation News for original articles, LN Radio, and our signature television program, The Conservative Five. Just go to libertynation.com on your browser, or hit Rumble, YouTube, or check out our Liberty Nation News Roku channel. I'm Scott Cosenza. Thanks for watching. This program is a production of libertynation.com, conservative news where truth matters.
Contributor for LibertyNation.com.
I think we're starting to make an impact. Liberty style. Fight for freedom.
Maybe tracking polls sponsored by Liberty Nation for Thursday.
Mentioned by Dan Bongino, Rasmussen, Jordan Peterson, and others.
I can do it again if you want me to.
Cited in Mark Levin's American Marxism.
I think we're starting to make a really big impact. Getting noticed. We're doing it. Rock on. I'm gone.